From KMUW Wichita.
From Toronto, Ontario.
And from Armia, Spain.
This is You're Saying It Wrong. Let's talk words. Let's talk weird word origins and when you think a word is related to something but isn't. I'm Fletcher Powell, host and producer at KMUW in Wichita, Kansas. And joining me, as they do every week, Kathy Petras and Ross Petras. Kathy Petras in Armia, Spain. How are you doing today, Kathy?
I'm just dandy. The rain stopped. We have snow in the Sierra, so everybody's really happy. And now it's sunny again.
Oh, lovely. The rains on the plains in Spain?
Yes, those. I can sing this for you, but I don't think anyone wants to hear
it. No, I don't know if you want to hear that, Kathy. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Ross.
Ross Petras in Toronto. How's it going, Ross?
How's it going, Fletcher?
I'm great. I'm in daylight saving time now, and so everything's thrown off, and I'm not really sure what time it is at all.
I am, too. It takes me a couple of weeks, usually, to really recover. We were talking about it this morning, though. Like, why can't we get rid of it? It doesn't help anyone anymore. It was fine when everything was rural and agrarian. People had to wake up with the pigs or the crops or something. But now we don't need it. I don't want it.
Wake up with the pigs. Yeah, you know, they threatened to get rid of it a while back. And I think it just stalled in one of the two houses of Congress. And it's just sitting there.
Yeah, we don't have it for two more weeks. Europe doesn't start until a little later, so.
One thing we have done is we did talk about the distinction. People say daylight savings, and it's not.
Uh-huh.
It's daylight saving time, if we all remember that.
Although now they accept Ross daylight savings because it's been so widely used.
Yes, they do, but I don't like it.
I say it.
I do too, but I don't like it.
So there.
I started saying daylight saving time, or tried to, when I found out that it's wrong. I mean, so, you know.
I've embraced the wrong one. I'm not giving it up. It's too ingrained.
I say savings. I try to say saving. But like I don't think I've ever had to say it like in a talk or anything. But right now, I'm going to say daylight saving time. So.
But that sounds wrong to me. It sounds like you're making, it's like we've talked about that before. How often when you're saying the correct thing, like we were talking about Forte Ford, when you're saying mm-hmm. it right, you sound like you're saying it wrong and everyone looks askance at you.
The paradoxes of human life. But
it's a complicated place to be, isn't it?
Yes. Earth, a complicated place to be. Yeah, I know. Speaking of Earth, the world turns on its axis, but sometimes it seems to it's hard to completely delineate a good year. And this has been a leap year. So, Kathy?
Before we get to the episode that we were going to talk about, we got an email a couple of days ago from a listener named Stephen, who said, I should have written a few weeks earlier, but oh well, happy leap year. He said, but I think leap years, this is actually very interesting. He said, I think the leap years were and are, say, 2021, 2022, 2023, not 2024, because the calendar leaps from February 28th, I said February 28th, to March 1st in those years. He said, it doesn't leap over on the 29th. It tarries. Glides. I like these, actually. I like tarries. But he said, I'm not sure, but I wonder if you could please discuss the term and what it is called in other languages. So we're going to do that very quickly to let Stephen know. So next time there's what we call a leap year that he thinks should be a gliding year or a tarrying year, what he can talk about.
Well, we did a little tiny bit of research because I actually didn't know the French term for it. And I don't think, Kathy, you know the Spanish term for it before we...
I did not.
So we both were very interested to find out that in French and in Spanish, it comes from the Latin bisextilis, which is the bisextilis, which is the B-I-S, so it's two times. And the sextus is... the sextile is the sixth day. And apparently it goes because in... Latin calendar, the Roman calendar, extra day was added on the sixth day before the March calends. We can get into how the Latins had their calendar, but I think it's really boring, and I think that suffices. But I liked, oddly enough, I vaguely remembered it, reading about it once in Arabic, which I always liked. And in Arabic, it's Sanat Kabisa, which in effect is the cabeza. Sanat is year, and the cabeza is sana or sanat, because the T aligns. Cabeza is squeezing in, or like kind of pressing. So in effect, you're pressing on an extra day into the year, which mm-hmm. I really liked. Mm-hmm. And for anyone interested, cabeza also refers to pickles. So you could call it the pickle year too, I guess.
Oh, in Spanish, it's el año bisiesto.
Bisiesto, like the bisextilius or whatever you said?
Yes.
Yes, same thing, yeah.
Well, so where does the leap come from? Do you have any idea?
I'll give you the Oxford definition. They're saying it comes from late Middle English, and they're guessing from the fact that feast days after February in a leap year fell 2 days later than the previous year, rather than 1 day later as in other years. And in effect, it leapt over a day.
Mm.
That's kind of confusing. I mean, I understand it. You're not your explanation. I'm saying I don't like this whole concept. The whole concept of leap year is very irritating to me.
Well, I looked it up with the bisextilis in Latin, and I was just like, okay, forget it. Calends,
yeah,
this
no,
day.
It's like, that's exactly what I thought. It's like, whatever. Yeah, leap year. Okay. So, want a glass of wine?
Yeah, I know.
Well, so, I mean, that kind of makes sense what you were saying, Russ. So the feast day comes 2 days later instead of 1 day later. Mm-hmm. And so you're leaping over that extra day. I mean, that makes sense mm-hmm. then why it would be a leap day. Because you're headed towards something and you have to stick an extra day in there and leap over that.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
So exactly. The leap isn't so much that referring to that day. It's referring to having to jump over an extra day to get to something later.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay, I can buy that.
Well, Fletcher, the
that's
world
right,
is
big
glad
if
that you
Fletcher.
Can.
Yes, I know. So shall we?
Why don't you explain it, Kath?
Okay. We're talking about weird word origins that make you think when a word looks like it's related to something, when something in the word reminds you of something else, but they're not related to the thing you think they're related to. But sometimes they are.
Yes, that's what I was waiting for, Kathy. That's what I was waiting for.
Well, we're trying to catch you, as we always do. So there might be a little twists here as we continue. The first word is bellwether.
Okay, it's something that leads or indicates a trend.
Yeah, okay. Bellwether. Bellwether. And it's good that I can see it written in front of me because, well, for a couple of reasons. One, I can never remember whether there's actually one L or two L's. And then weather, that part of the word makes you think about the weather, about clouds and storms and wind and that sort of thing.
So that's where we're going to ask you. What do you think the origin of this word is? We have three for you to tell us which it is. The origin of bellwether is based upon one, a bell used to mark weather pressure changes. Two, a castrated sheep. Three, an earlier variant of wither, as in whither this goes, so go we.
The tendency, of course, is to choose the bell with the weather. This one, somewhere in the back of my brain, I remember hearing that it had something to do with like the bell around a sheep's neck. And so I'm pretty sure it's the castrated sheep, but I don't exactly remember anything else about that besides just a cute little sheep wandering around going tinkle, tinkle, tinkle with the bell.
And now the bell will go ding, ding, ding. You're right.
Yay, okay.
Absolutely right. Yes. It technically meant initially bellwether was the lead sheep of a domesticated flock. And this was this lead sheep around his neck was a bell.
Okay.
So it was exactly what you're saying. The castrated sheep is correct.
There's hardly a leap at all then to turn that into the meaning that we have now. I mean, it was the lead sheep. It was the thing that was mm-hmm. leading the metaphorical trend, I guess, the actual sheep. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But the one thing that sort of interested me about this one when we were doing it is that the weather part that we were talking about actually is like related in a very distant way to a Proto-Indo-European word meaning speaking of leap year. It meant year. Wet was apparently meant year. Isn't that cool?
Hmm.
And then for some reason it came to mean like a lamb, because like a lamb would be a yearling you know, every year a new lamb comes.
Wow.
So then it became with our whatever, and then from there it drifted off into castrated sheep. Isn't that cool?
Yeah. So the weather in this case is refers to the sheep, and the bellwether is the one with the bell leading the other
right.
sheep.
Right.
That is,
right.
That so is really
it's
neat.
It's literally the belled sheep.
Yeah.
Yes. But originally the weather part meant year, and then it got gradually changed into a calf, yearling, then from there into sheep. It's really cool.
Okay.
Okay. The next word, Fletcher, is shamefaced.
What was the origin? We have the concept of a sham, i.e. sham-faced, someone who put on a glamour. If you recall, like a glamour in the old days was a something to deceive people in your expression.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, number two, a truncation of the word shaman with the word face, referring to religious spells intended to punish an individual. Three, a corruption of the word fast, as in someone held fast or restrained by shame.
Wow.
These were good, Ross. These are good little examples.
Those are hard. The one with the shaman seems out there. I don't want to choose that one. I'll choose the first one. The one about the sham-faced.
Well, unfortunately, Fletcher, you had a 50-50 chance with those two. And the other, you got the wrong. In this case, it's a corruption of the word fast, as in someone held fast. It's not really a corruption, but it's a replacement, really. But it's someone was held fast or restrained by shame.
Fascinating.
And then from there, it migrated into faced. But it's a different meaning.
Tell me more. What was the original word?
Well, the original word would have been shamfast, shamefast. In effect, you're basically, or in Old English, scamfast, which is you're restrained by shame or firm in modesty. You're held fast,
huh.
As you know, when you know you're held by it, by your shame, which makes a lot of sense, I think.
Yeah, and then it just sort of changed over time into having shame in your face.
Yeah, mm-hmm. In effect, sort of like a folk etymology backwards. Ah,
yeah.
You're mispronouncing it. I mean, it's faced.
Right.
Yeah, because you're ashamed of your behavior, you look like you're ashamed, so it can't be fast.
Yeah.
It must be faced. Yeah.
I love how that happens in language, how we make, you know, we explain things, we go backwards and explain things, and we change them because we've, you know, we have a better explanation. We've done that before with dull as ditch water. Becoming dull as dishwater. We don't see ditches, so we go, oh, it's dishwater. Nowadays, we don't even see dishes, so it's going to be dull as water in your...
your dishwasher?
Yeah,
although dull in our dishwater. House, I'm the dishwasher, so...
Okay, our next one is interesting. It's outrage.
Outrage.
To cause someone to feel very angry, shocked, or upset. Okay, so what's the origin? Number one... Leftover rags from early papermaking. The E was added later and soon came to mean excess, problematic, and then from there it came to mean bad. Two, a word for anger at the gods, coming into English from the Norman French, orage, which is hurricane or great storm. Or three, going beyond or outside of the boundaries.
Outrage. So leftover rags, and over time that just got worse and worse. Anger at the gods. And the last one was outside of the boundaries. I like the first one because we've talked about pejoration before and how something relatively innocuous just becomes terrible. So I'm going to go with that one. Leftover rags just gets worse and worse.
Ha ha! We're outraged by your choice. No, we were... This, I've got to give Ross credit. Pat on the back to Ross. Ross came up with that one. I thought it was brilliant. The leftover rats.
Yeah, it's good.
Paper
it's really good.
Very plausible. Uh-huh. It's also very wrong. Very wrong.
It's a shame that I wish it were true. I really like that one, too. It'd be cool if it were, but whatever.
Yeah, we should just start doing this, Ross. Just we could, like, fill books with this. We'd be shocked. No, it was number three, going beyond.
Oh, okay.
As in the out of the boundary. So you're passing out of reasonable bounds. And it began just literally as from the Latin. We have the whole thing here, which Ross can read because I don't know my Latin pronunciations. From the vulgar Latin, yeah.
Ultraticum.
Excess from the Latin ultra, beyond. So it initially just meant passing beyond reasonable bounds. Then it did basically become not really pejoration as much as it just became to mean out a folk etymology, outrage. It was outside of feelings of regular principles. You're just shocked. You're extremely upset. It's an affront.
But the interesting thing is the rage never was an original part of it. It was at, like Kath just said, it was folk etymology. It was added on.
Oh.
Which, if we have a set, yeah, it was like, because it was the ultracatum became ultrag or ultrage in old French, ultrage. But it was it was never rage in that sense at all.
Mm-hmm.
So it came on as an after effect, which really reminds me of my favorite little bit of folk etymology. It came from years ago on the show where you put in your, like you had old stuff and you would go on. What was the name of that show?
Antiques Roadshow?
Antique Roadshow. Yeah. And this woman comes on with a Stradivarius violin, which she claimed. And she says inside it, you can see it said Facubat Ani. 1713. She was really excited. And she said this came from her great-great-great-grandmother, whose name was Facubat Ani from Italy. And she went on and on talking about how she had found out on about Facubat Ani. And I listened to that, and in Latin, Facubat means it was made. Then Ani presumably was a thing with
the year, honor, right?
With the year.
Yeah.
So it literally, really, she had the I ending is wrong, but it was Facubat Anno, 1713. And it turns out there was a whole range of facsimiles Stradivarius has made, all of which had Facubat Anno, 1713. She was completely wrong, but she really believed it.
Oh, no.
It was really interesting to hear it. She was crushed.
She thought that was her great-great-grandmother's name?
Yeah. And she kept going on about it. How she
Maybe it was made by ear. Yes.
Oh.
But it was interesting because, I mean, you know, perhaps she was, maybe she was lying. I don't think, she just had, she believed it. You could just tell.
Yeah.
It was so sad.
Oh.
But that's how a folk etymology gets going. I mean, you know, like her kids are going to believe it, and then her grandkids are going to believe it.
Yeah.
That's why it pays to do etymological research, I think.
before you go on Antiques Roadshow.
You bet, yeah.
All right. Now, this word is a very basic one. The word is human, H-U-M-A-N, as in the most common and widespread species of primate, the last surviving species of the genus Homo. Human.
Thanks for clearing that up. Yes, good.
I want to make sure we knew what we're talking about. What is this one based on? Human. One, from an ancient word for dirt, which has stayed with us in the modern humus, as in the soil. Two, a reference to a higher being, as in above or hue, compared to animals, comparing animals with man. Or three, from an old Germanic word for a chieftain or prominent leader.
You guys thought about these, didn't you? This is nice. I like it when my choices are also enticing. I want to, you know what? I think I've chosen the first one quite a few times now, and I don't think it's worked out for me yet, but I'm going to again. Something about dirt, and I'm going to do it because, you know, humans, we can imagine a creator god making humans out of dirt and forming them.
Good for you, Fletcher. You got it right. I'm proud of you. It's exactly the case. It comes, they believe, and the problem with these are quite speculative, but they do believe it comes from the Proto-Indo-European, the very earliest form of, you know, the great-great-great-great-great-great-grandparents, the Facubat Ani 5,000 times of English,
uh-huh.
of a word meaning, I can't pronounce this at all in Proto-Indo-European, but Rem or Chem or Hem, something like that.
Oh, that D-H-G-H-E-M is how it's
Yeah, naturally, D-H-G-H-E-M.
Yeah, which we all know. Yes, you're right. Interestingly enough, in Hebrew, Adam, you know, as in Adam, comes from Adama, ground as well.
So, I mean, was I headed in the right direction with that creating humans out of the dirt,
yes.
out of the earth?
Yeah, because it's supposed to be the difference of an earthly being as opposed to a godly
right.
being,
okay.
if you
mm-hmm.
will.
Yeah.
So that was an interesting one because it makes so much sense, you know, when you think about it. But I never thought about where did human come from, ever.
You're kidding.
No. Well, did you really thought about where does the word human come from? I never have. I'm an accepting person, Ross.
I thought you meant where do humans come from? I thought you were talking about the concept,
oh, no.
Not the word. That's like a shock. Kathy just accepts what is. And, you know, like,
whatever.
I've never thought about existence, Ross. Or
yeah, no.
I think a college student talked about that in the dorm.
Yeah, I was going to say, this is why Kathy gave up philosophy in college.
Yes, right.
I don't have time for this.
I gotta go to work.
Our next word is fun. It's checkmate, often shortened to mate. And it's a game position in chess and other chess-like games in which the player's king is then in check and then he's captured.
Mm-hmm.
So does checkmate come, one, from an old nautical term referring to the first mate having to make certain things shipshape, from an Arabic word meaning death, from a Persian word meaning king?
Okay, I love nautical origins, but I'm not going to go with that. I like Arabic or Persian because that's more toward where, you know, chess would have come from. So I'm going to go with the Persian one with the king.
Well, Fletcher, you were partly correct, and it's not fair on our part. Because this was this was one where two and three combined are correct.
Okay.
The Persian word for king is shah, and the Arabic word for death is mat. So it comes from, like, in Arabic, you would say shah mat, the king dies. I don't know actually what the Persian word for death is, though, but I do know what the Arabic word is mat, is death. So it's shah mat, the king is dead, long live the king.
But this is what fascinates me, though, is how language, again, we go back to developing, like shah mat becoming checkmate, we make it into words that the person speaking the language understands.
Mm-hmm.
The
shahmat
doesn't mean anything, but checkmate does.
Mm-hmm.
The only problem with that, though, is it does make sense in terms of a word, but it doesn't make sense in terms of understanding. Like, why mate?
No, you're absolutely right. Okay, next, we should go to school. But we're speaking of school in a specific meaning, that of a group of fish that swim together in a synchronized fashion, moving in the same direction at the same speed and turning simultaneously. Which, incidentally, people think a school of fish is just a group of fish, but technically a school is when they're swimming together in a synchronized fashion.
Oh, okay, because I would have thought, okay, this is just like a murder of crows or whatever. It's just the name of the group. I mean, when I imagine a group of fish, they're doing that, right? They're all swimming together simultaneously.
You're saying they're schooling.
But school actually means they need to be doing those things to be a school.
Yeah, I think otherwise it's a shoal only.
Oh.
As I think.
Coming from an old salt like you, Kath, I'll believe you.
We had a lot in Manhattan, Ross, let me tell you. Yes, a fish, when aquatic creatures swim together in a loose cluster, it's a shoal.
All right.
And it could be a mix of different species. A school is same species, synchronized swimming.
Wow.
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
But when you think about it, you go, the fish are schooling. I've heard people say that on my many jaunts out at sea as well.
Okay, so where did that come from?
Okay, from the number one, from the ancient Greek skole, spare time, leisure, rest, ease, or idleness. Number two, from an old Proto-Indo-European word meaning to cut. Three, from the old Dutch word skol, or something like that, meaning flatfish.
Before you gave me the options, I felt like I wanted it to be something related to Dutch or something like that language, just because of how it sounded. I wanted it to be, you know, school or skol or something like that.
Yeah.
I have no idea. No offense to all of our listeners who speak Dutch. I really apologize for those sounds that I just made. but I'm going to choose that one. I'll choose the one related to Dutch. Number three.
Well, Fletcher, that was a good guess. And in a way, it comes from apparently another word from the Dutch, skol, which means a group of fish, which comes backwards from the West Germanic skulo, West Frisian skol, then with a literal, but basically going all the way back to, again, Proto-Indo-European, skel, meaning to cut. So the real meaning is an old Indo-European word meaning to cut, we think. We cannot be sure. Yeah. These things are really very difficult to figure out, but it does appear so far that that does seem to be the origin. And it's an effect to cut, apparently...
a division, they thought, literally. It was the literal sense of division.
So that makes sense then.
Yeah, because you're saying, like, this is a school... Okay, you're seeing an
cut
army.
Apart
this
from,
battalion
yeah.
is one school. It's one group. It's a division yeah. of the whole thing. So a school of fish. You're the ocean is very big, Ross. There are many aquatic creatures in it. This particular group is a division of all those aquatic creatures that swims together in a synchronized fashion.
Yes.
So you're cutting that group out from the multitude.
Okay. This is one of my favorite, I don't know why I'm saying my favorite word is vomitorium.
But well, didn't every kid love the word?
I love the word. Okay.
Okay, vomitorium. Okay.
Vomitorium. Okay. One, does it come from a place where ancient Romans would vomit after eating too much at banquets? First mentioned in Petronius's Satyricon. Two, a specific type of ancient auditorium. Three, an opening in a theater leading to seats.
Oh, ooh, good. Okay. Well, I always thought it was the first one, just because, I don't know, you always imagine the decadence and eating too much and going and throwing up and then coming back and eating more and so on. I kind of like the opening in the theater one, though. That kind of makes a little bit of sense to me. I want to go with that.
Very good.
Very good. It does mean a passage or opening in an ancient amphitheater leading to or from the seats. But it does actually come from vomitare in Latin, meaning to vomit.
Oh.
Well, because it's you're ejecting
yeah,
people.
Yeah, expelling.
You're ejecting,
right?
Expelling, exactly.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, you're expelling it. But interestingly enough, the vomitorium one, which we all grew up thinking that when we were kids, at least I certainly did, that actually is really late. The idea of that being the place for vomiting comes apparently from 1869 only.
Yeah. Well, we always have these weird concepts of what Roman life was like, right?
Yeah. Although I, Claudius, well, they never vomited, but it seemed pretty intense.
Although I remember back in Hoboken, there were a bunch of people and they were at a bar.
And I like where this is
they
going.
They would go. I know. But literally, I was sort of shocked. They would drink a lot, and then a couple times they'd go to the washroom or bathroom and apparently vomit, and then come back and go, now I can drink some more.
I thought, not my God. Oh, yeah. I mean, a lot of us did that, people. I'm not saying necessarily that I did, but I
no,
might
I'm
have.
The type of I can't even think of it. I mean, I have like the, you know, like the... if someone's doing it, I go like, oh my God, I get nauseous.
Is this like a well-known pastime in Hoboken? What is going on?
It was in those days, a long time ago.
Yeah,
it was pretty bad
in Hoboken in those days. I don't remember what's your house. Not your house, literally, but outside of it.
Wow. You're Saying It Wrong is part of the NPR network and is produced in the studios of KMUW in Wichita, Kansas, by me, Fletcher Powell. Kathy Petras records from her home in Armia, Spain. Ross Petras from his home in Toronto, Ontario, in Canada. Torin Anderson composed our theme music, and our digital team is Beth Golay, Kate Hutchins, and Carly Cooper. If you have a question for Kathy and Ross, you can email me at powell@kmuw.org or email them at kandrpetras@gmail.com. You can find all of their books pretty much anywhere you get books, and a handful of them are also available on audiobook, read by the authors themselves. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back next week.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.